Hey, this is Noah Levine, founder of Against the Stream, Refuge Recovery, and Dharma Punks. Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. I hope you're enjoying the Dharma. Together, may we create a positive change on this planet. If you feel moved to leave a donation, there's a link in the show notes. May our paths cross soon. Welcome, everybody. How many people here for the first time tonight? Welcome, 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 welcome. Special welcome. Welcome to anybody joining us for the first time at home. This is an ongoing Buddhist meditation class. I've been teaching this Monday night class for over 20 years, every Monday on the west side of Los Angeles. And I like to do series of teachings where if you come regularly, we kind of systematically explore different aspects of the Buddha's teachings. I'm right now in a series on mindfulness. We're coming towards the end of it, but we're in the fourth foundation of mindfulness, the fourth aspect of the mindfulness meditation practices. And there's five aspects, and we're on the third part of the five. So anyways, hopefully it'll still make sense for those of you who are just showing up for the first time. I like to start class, a central part of the Buddha's teachings was the importance of community, of connecting, and the perspective that in this world, it's very rare to have wisdom or to be trying to develop wisdom. It's not the norm. The norm is confusion and ignorance and self-centered fear. That's the normal human condition. And actually to try to be awake and kind and compassionate and loving and generous and awake is a rare and precious thing, and that we need each other in the process. We need other like-minded people, what the Buddha called Sangha. He said, take refuge in wise people and relationships with other people who are also trying to be awake. So I like to start class by asking you to talk to each other so that, because there's a weird thing about meditation groups where you come and you meditate and listen to a talk and then you leave and you never meet anybody there. So I try to make, I force some icebreakers. I force you to meet each other, not just meditate, but also interact. Tonight's topic on the fourth foundation is the list of teachings called the seven factors of enlightenment, seven aspects of the awakened mind. So for your icebreaker, it's too big of a topic, but I was thinking, give you a big one. Now, the problem with these little small groups is that you have like 1 minute each to talk to each other. And then I give you this big topic. Like, I have 1 minute to. So I thought that for you have like 1 minute each and you go around one and a half minutes or so and you go around at home. I put you in the breakout rooms and I thought maybe you could share. Like, what's the one of the interesting, the most interesting, something interesting that's happened in your meditation practice? You know, your body ever dissolve into light? You ever feel happy for no reason while you're meditating? You ever, kind of get a level of concentration where the noise quiets down, you settle into? A couple weeks ago, I talked about the five hindrances and that sort of the state of mind where the mind is having doubt or it's having anxiousness or it's experiencing sloth and torpor, that kind of sleepy dullness or there's craving, you know, that kind of when you're sitting here meditating, your mind's like, if I was comfortable, I'd be happy. Or if the temperature was better, I'd be happy. Or all of that desire-based thought process. Does that stuff ever go away for you? It can be really simple when we're talking about meditative experiences, you know, there's the kind of one time I was meditating and I just felt my breath. It's amazing. It was like a miracle. It doesn't have to be some bright light, blissful experience. Sometimes it's just I'm here. And I'm never here. I'm always off in the future or I'm off in the past or planning, remembering, judging, fearing. And sometimes that simple experience of present time awareness is it. That's it. I was present. I was fully present. And that, and kind of Thich Nhat Hanh used to call it the miracle of mindfulness, just being present. So small groups share something interesting that has happened in your meditation practice. If you've never meditated before, just make some shit up. Although the Buddhist mindfulness teachings are meditation instructions, they are the guide. This is how to train your mind, your awareness to pay attention and investigate, and it gives very specific instructions. They are also a description of what happens when you pay close attention. And some of the descriptions, some of the instructions, like this, is a little bit of the advanced description of what will happen if you meditate long term, these seven awakening factors. And so if you're fairly new to meditation, you might not be experiencing much of this. And I'll put a little bit in the guided meditation. But if you're not experiencing it yet, it's okay. Just kind of don't try to force anything to happen. You're just paying attention to what's here. And just knowing that this is kind of a lot of the instructions are like, here's the map. And if you keep going, this is some of the terrain it will take you through. And maybe you just haven't, you know, you got to keep walking, you got to keep practicing, and you might not be experiencing joy in meditation or equanimity or rapture or deep levels of concentration, but probably just because you're not good at meditating yet. And if you get good at it, if you keep going, that was a joke. That was supposed to be funny. You're not good at it. You're terrible meditators. Not funny, okay. Does that make sense? Description. A lot of the instructions are descriptions of what happens along the way. So, and that we're not trying to force it, but we're just trying to keep investigating and being present with what happens. And then when it happens, you go, oh, that's what the fuck they were talking about. That's what I didn't quite get in the, you know, the book or the instructions, or it's not our experience until it's our experience. So have take a posture, a meditation way to sit, whatever feels right to you. The basic posture encouragement is upright. Find a way to sit that is upright, that's not too tense. So relaxed, upright position. And I turned on the AC in here because it was getting up into the high 70s. And I want you to have a pleasant meditation. So it'll be cold now, unpleasant. As you're ready, adjusting, softening, settling, allowing the eyes to be gently closed, releasing any of the unnecessary tension in the face, the jaw, shoulders, chest, belly. Each time you exhale, see if you can soften that center channel down the throat and heart and belly. And some emphasis on relaxing into the posture, letting the body be upright without being tense, and letting the breath come and go naturally. Let the body breathe however it wants to breathe. And take a moment to remember why you meditate, your intention, your aspiration. Whatever that intention is. I'm certain that it will go better if you bring kindness, friendliness, acceptance, what the Buddha called metta, loving kindness, as part of the intention for the moment-to-moment awareness. Let it be infused with kindness, with friendliness. Beginning with the first foundation of mindfulness, mindfulness of the body. Spend the first few minutes ignoring your mind, paying full attention to the physical, the sensation of sitting on the chair, the cushion. And using the breath as the anchor. Breathing in, know that you're breathing in, breathing out. Feel the breath as it comes and goes. As the primary object of awareness, let everything else be in the background. Finding the right effort, the balanced energy of returning to the chosen object, focusing, gathering the attention, choosing to disengage from the planning mind, over and over coming back, but doing so in a relaxed, a kind, an accepting way. Effort is part of the seven factors of awakening. Being mindful of how you're directing your attention, how you're training the mind. Being able to choose what you're paying attention to. One of the other aspects of the awakened mind is investigation, being able to inquire, contemplate, investigate what's happening right now. Investigating the impermanent nature of each breath. How do the sensations change? What's the temperature, the texture? The duration of each breath. We also use investigation to identify the feeling tone, the second foundation of mindfulness, what's being perceived as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. If you're new to this kind of meditation practice, you can continue to just focus on the breath, disengaging from the thoughts, coming back to the breath over and over. But the Buddha's instructions expand from the narrow concentration focus to a fully embodied awareness, present time, non-judgmental, kind, investigative awareness of your whole being, your heart, your mind, the sense doors, the sounds, the smells, sights and tastes, this whole body, all of the phenomena of a body included in our mindfulness. Rather than ignoring the mind, the third foundation, opening to the mind. What's your mind up to? What kind of thoughts are arising and passing through? Mindful of the process, the impermanent nature of thought, and also the content, the cravings, the judgments, the fears. So, being mindful of the mental process, the thoughts. Opening to the fourth foundation, are any of the hindrances present? Is there torpor or anxiousness, doubt, or craving? Or aversion, anger, fear? When any of these mind states are present, it's hard to see the seven awakened factors, the factor of mindfulness, concentration, the effort, the investigation that can lead to the experience of tranquility, serenity. The experience of joy, rapture, happiness, as well as the equanimity, the balanced, unperturbable wisdom. You find yourself resisting what's happening in any way, whether it's a sensation, an emotion, or a mind state, try to soften your belly. Try to allow, relax into this experience, even if it's unpleasant. Resistance tends to make it worse. Experiment with allowing yourself to be uncomfortable. If you notice craving for this moment to be different than it is, try to let go, to again allow. Allow the impermanent nature, allow the moment-to-moment unfolding be the kindest thing we can do at times is just to accept our experience just as it is. Present time, non-judgmental awareness at times leads to tranquility, mind settles, experience of serenity, serenity with what is happening, at ease with what is. Sometimes leads to joy, to an experience of sukha. Sukha is happiness, joy that comes from your very being, not a sense pleasure derived happiness, but from your own heart, from your own mind. The experience of equanimity, the balanced, open, inclusive, non-resistance. Ending with just a couple of minutes of loving kindness, saying to yourself, may I be happy, may I be at ease, may I be free. Saying to yourself, may I do what needs to be done to experience true happiness and ease, freedom. Saying to yourself, I am doing what needs to be done to experience true happiness and ease and freedom. This is the practice that will lead to that destination. And then extending this loving kindness to each other. May you be happy. May you be at ease. May you be free. May you do what needs to be done in your life to develop the wisdom, the compassion, the forgiveness that's necessary. And extending this as a group outward in all directions until we cover the entire planet with goodwill, with loving kindness, with compassion, friendliness. May all beings be at ease. May all beings be happy. May all beings be free from suffering. Before I jump into the topic of the seven dwarves, any questions about the meditation instructions or how to practice in this way? All right, jump in. We spend a couple of minutes just exploring together even the name of this teaching, this list, this aspect of the fourth foundation of mindfulness, the seven factors, sometimes called the seven factors of enlightenment or sometimes called the seven factors of awakening. And awakening and enlightenment may be interchangeable. Maybe some real Buddhist nerds would have some discrepancies, you know, with the different awakening is this and enlightenment is that. I don't know. I'm not smart enough. I think they're the same thing, to be awake, to be enlightened. And the context of it is that it's a super rare, supernatural. I don't know if that's right. That sounds like ghosts or something, but a super rare quality. It's not common to be awake. That actually the norm is for the mind to be confused and cloudy, and the normal human condition is more like being asleep and being in darkness or in dullness or in confusion or ignorance is the norm. And to be awake to reality as it is and to see it clearly is not common. It's not what's happening for even those of us who've been meditating for a long time, still mostly seeing things through some deluded lenses and some self-centered views and opinions. And to actually enlighten, to actually have the lights on, to actually really be seeing clearly. And I don't think it's only, many of you have heard me talk about, like when we talk about the third noble truth, this whole meditation practice, which is leading us to the third noble truth, enlightenment is possible. And the way that I think about that, what it means to me is it's possible to see clearly the nature of all things, that the human mind has the capacity to see the impermanent nature, the impersonal nature, the unreliable nature of all things, and to see the tendency to cling and to let go, to have a non-attached relationship to pleasure, non-attached appreciation, and to have a compassionate relationship to pain, responding with empathy and care and mercy and forgiveness rather than anger and fear and hatred and resentment. It's actually possible for us to train the mind to get to that place where we see clearly the cause of suffering is clinging and aversion, self-centeredness, and clinging to our views and opinions. This creates suffering, and waking up to that and then stopping, having an intervention and getting off of the clinging, aversion, self-centeredness, addictive, reactive cycle that we are all in. And I don't just mean you, I mean all of humanity. This is the nature of the world. I, me, mine. Clinging to pleasure, aversion to pain, ego identification is the norm. It's the norm. And then to be awake means seeing clearly, oh, that's a dead end, and learning to respond wisely, appropriately, non-clinging, compassion, non-identification, not taking it all so personal, I, me, mine. So the seven factors of seeing clearly and responding appropriately, of being awake, of enlightenment. And I mean, I gotta admit, when I talk about enlightenment, having been, kind of practicing and contemplating and hanging around the Buddhists and some of the Hindu and other spiritual tradition scenes for coming on 40 years now, I can get a little skeptical about, like, is enlightenment really, like, where the fuck are the enlightened people? Where are they? The Buddha says third noble truth, it's possible, but I've met most of the heavy hitters and been pretty disappointed by most of the spiritual masters that I've met. Not all of them. Some of them I've been very impressed by. So, setting aside whether or not enlightenment is actually possible or not, and maybe kind of reframing it to these are desirable states of mind. This is a process that, at the very least, I'm 100% convinced that what they do is they decrease our confusion and our unhappiness and our suffering. And it works for sure in the process of, from direct experience, I know it works for sure in the decreasing of unhappiness and the increasing of happiness and a sense of well-being in one's life. Whether I'm going to get fully enlightened, or if that's really a thing, or that our definition of being able to see clearly all of the time and respond wisely all of the time, I don't know if that's a thing or not, but I'd like to, I'd like to believe it's a thing. And two ways of thinking about this seven factors of awakening. So the seven factors, I don't know if you caught them in the beginning and in the meditation, the seven factors are mindfulness, right? And that's what we're doing. So be mindful of mindfulness, concentration, investigation, effort, joy, tranquility, and equanimity. Those are the seven. And I think it's quite interesting that three of them are the last three aspects of the Eightfold Path. Effort, mindfulness, and concentration are the sixth, seventh, and eighth aspects of the whole instructions. The path to liberation includes effort, mindfulness, these four foundations of mindfulness, and concentration, and finding a balance between the mind that is concentrated and which is a narrow focus, and the mind that is mindful, which is a bit more inclusive, not so narrow. Two weeks ago, I talked about the five hindrances. Mindfulness, my definition, is present time, non-judgmental awareness. Expanded definition is present time, non-judgmental, kind. I think, although in the traditional instructions in mindfulness, kindness isn't in there, but I think it's just useful to bring an attitude of kindness, of friendliness, so that mindfulness doesn't become a detached observation, but there's some heart and some friendliness and some acceptance in it, rather than just, I'm observing from afar, I'm in it, I'm feeling it, I'm intimate with it, and a friendly, it being our moment-to-moment experience. Non-judgmental, present time, investigative, kind awareness. And the quality of investigation, also on this seven factors of awakening, that mindfulness isn't just watching, but it's inquiring. It's investigating. What's the feeling tone? Is this pleasant or unpleasant? Investigating the three characteristics. How is this changing? What's the impermanent? How do I directly experience impermanence in this breath, or in this sensation in the body, or in this thought in the mind or emotion that's coming through, arising and passing? The refrain over and over, the focus. The reminder that the Buddha gives us over and over is pay attention to how it arises, sustains, and passes. It being everything. There's nothing outside of the it. It being thoughts and sensations and emotions and sights and smells and sounds and all of the phenomena at the sense doors and internally and externally arising and passing. So we start mindfulness with breath, body, and on some level what we're doing is we're building concentration. By choosing to ignore the mind, we're gathering the attention, we're focusing the attention. Now I know the term concentration isn't necessarily the best one for a lot of people, where it feels like there's sort of concentration is like kind of a tight, I gotta concentrate. Rather than maybe try to think about it as just focus and gather the attention rather than, but it's choosing. Concentration is choosing what I'm going to pay attention to and choosing to ignore some other shit, all of the other shit. I'm choosing the breath. I'm choosing the footsteps and walking meditation. I'm choosing to focus on, you know, some particular. You might just choose to concentrate to gather the attention on the sensation of the body in the chair. Or one of the instructions I don't give a lot, but Rod and I were talking about earlier, is choosing to just do listening meditation and listening to that high-pitched ringing in the ears, what Ajahn Sumedho calls the sound of silence. And you can, if it's too loud, it's called tinnitus, but that ringing in the ears, or like after loud music where your ears are ringing, but that ringing that's, it's always happening. And most people can tune into it as a meditation, to focus on, to concentrate. Usually we use the breath as the main instruction for that. Starting with gathering the attention, using, as you see, we're present time awareness, we're gathering the attention, we're building some concentration, some focus, we're using investigation, inquiry, what's happening, how does it feel, how is it changing, all of that. It's not just detached witness consciousness, it's engaged, it's questioning, it's investigating it. That's part of the practice. And there's a natural tendency to be like, well, I'm trying to ignore my mind, so I'm trying not to think. And so I'm not allowed to use my mind to think about what's happening right now. But it's a mistake you are allowed to use your mind, you're encouraged in this kind of meditation to use your mind to think about what's happening right now. Thoughts are not the enemy. We actually get to use the mind to inquire, to investigate, to think about what's happening. That's contemplation. That's investigation. What's happening right now? We are trying to put a prohibition, to not think about the future, to not think about the past. We're trying to not engage in our planning mind and our remembering mind, but we are trying to use the mind to think about what's happening right now. What is this? What am I feeling? How is it changing? How am I responding, reflecting and investigating and thinking about what's happening moment to moment? So our mindfulness practice is actually, we're building concentration, we're using investigation. And I said in the beginning of the meditation instructions, even that when you're doing the concentration in particular, but also with the mindfulness, there's an amount of effort that's necessary, right? You don't get to just sit here and be like, okay, pay attention. It's this redirecting. Every time you have to come back to the breath, every time you have to come back to the present time experience, which is, I mean, how many times in the 30-minute meditation? 10, 20, 100, 500. And so every time that there's that intentional reconnecting, reestablishing mindfulness, it's the effort, right? So that's on the list. It's the sixth factor of the Eightfold Path. It's the, I don't know, maybe third thing that's mentioned in the seven factors of awakening. This list of seven isn't in order. It doesn't need to be like, well, then first this and then that. I don't think that that's the way it's taught, but they're just seven things. So you already do, right? So as I explain this, these first three or four you're familiar with, right? Mindfulness, trying to gather the attention, concentration, investigating, and the effort to connect and sustain and reconnect and re-sustain. So those four are familiar probably to most people. Like, oh, yeah, that's what I'm doing while I'm meditating. Trying to be mindful, I'm trying to be concentrated, I'm trying to have the effort to return when my attention wanders, coming back, trying to investigate. So those are that's the first part of the list. Now, my sense, kind of going back to the five hindrances in the list that appears in this fourth foundation first. First, you'll be, and in some ways, I feel like the Buddha is saying, when you're mindful, the description, when you start looking at your mind, first you're going to see the hindrances. You're going to look at your mind and you're going to see craving and you're going to see aversion and you're going to see doubt and you're going to see anxiousness and you're going to see torpor and sloth and laziness and sleepiness. And that's the, because that's the surface. And that's the sort of, if we want to go with the light, enlightenment or awake, that's actually what's clouding our vision. That's why it's hard to see clearly because the mind has such a tendency towards craving and aversion, and they're kind of like dark clouds in the mind. Craving, aversion, doubt, unworthiness, all of the self-centered unworthiness, insecurity, it's all doubt about our true nature, about who we actually are. And it clouds our vision. We don't see clearly when we're Mara's attacking. The doubting mind and the judging mind and the craving mind. And first, mindfulness reveals the bad news. And if you don't keep going, you'll be like, oh, fuck meditation. I gotta sit there in my mind. Just judges the shit out of me and everybody else the whole time. This is no fun at all. Because that seems to be the surface. I was thinking about like a microscope. Like if you t like mindfulness as the sort of ways that we're focusing in on and looking a little bit more clearly. And first, like there's like smudges on the, what are they called that you look at the microscope? Slides. There's slides, and then there's like a glass piece on top of the glass piece, but it's like smudged. And so you're trying to look in there, and you're like, this thing's, my mind is dirty. I've got a really smudged, hindered, filthy mind. And I'm not reading your mind. This is just human nature. It's self-centered, fear-based, craving, aversion. That's what's smudging, hindering. But the Buddha's saying, like, actually, when you get concentrated, now there's two ways to think about these seven factors. One is that when you get really concentrated, like the jhanas, the absorptions that happens, if you meditate long term, and this probably isn't going to happen in your 30-minute a day meditation practice. It might, you might get glimpses of it, but it's more likely to happen if you go on a long meditation retreat, or if you have set up your life where you're practicing for like 1 or 2 hours of solid meditation in a day. If you're, kind of, or you do retreat where you get days to start to settle in and concentrate down. That concentration has a way of penetrating through the hindrances. Of maybe it's cleaning the slide. It's somehow it's keeping doubt, keeping Mara, keeping the torpor and the anxiousness and the craving. It has a concentration as a way of like penetrating through it, getting below it, keeping it at bay. I don't know what the, kind of dispersing the clouds, turning the light on. And that when the light gets turned on, especially in those deep states of concentration, what happens is you're looking and you're focusing and you're like, whoa, there's joy in here. What the fuck just happened? I was just meditating and I'm like happier than I've ever been, better than an orgasm. This is amazing. And all I'm doing is sitting here meditating. And there's this embodied joyous, it's called rapture, piti, sukha, these ecstatic, blissful, unlocking states that when the hindrances aren't there, there's a sense of joy, of rapture. That just unlocks. There's some part of the heart. And although on this list it's piti, which is rapture and happiness, it's very much connected to, you know, the term for the first noble truth? The noble truth of dukkha, suffering. It's a noble truth. It's where the Buddha starts the teaching. In life, there will be suffering, dukkha. And it even sounds bad, dukkha. Maybe because it sounds like dookie, I don't know, but it just sounds dukkha. Might be my conditioning around it, but for me, just the term sounds heavy. Fucking dukkha. Suffering of life. Not all of life, but there's going to be some, for sure. Unavoidably, there's going to be some. And this term sukha, which is, it's kind of the opposite. It's not going to, life's not all suffering. There's also happiness. And just like dukkha kind of is, you know, happens, the untrained mind just creates it all by itself. The trained mind unlocks sukha, this spiritual, non-material, I call it spiritual because it's not based in sense pleasure. It's not a material based, it's emotional, intelligence that is innate to your being. Happiness that has no external source. It's not because something, you didn't just win the lottery, but it's that feeling of like, you know, that feeling when you get, somebody gives you something that you, and you're just like so excited. You're like, I just got this thing, or I just won the lottery, or I just got a promotion, or I'm in love. I just met the one. You know that feeling, and it just feels like, wow, this is amazing. I feel so elated. It's like that, but you didn't meet anybody. You didn't win anything. You're not, you know, there's no external source. It's just in you. It's in your heart. It's in your being. Rapturous. That when you clean away the hindrances, when Mara isn't attacking, you know, like talked about Mara as greed and hatred and delusion. When you're concentrated enough that Mara is at bay, there's joy, part of our natural being, bliss. Now, I'm hesitant to talk about it because it sounds so cheesy, but it's true. And I've experienced it a lot. And I know when I've experienced, especially on longer retreats, like I haven't done that many long retreats, but I did one-month retreat. I did a few, mostly 10-day retreats. And then I did one 90-day silent retreat. In the middle of this 90-day, you know, doing just like months and months of silence, sitting for an hour, walking for an hour, sitting for an hour, I was so fucking happy some of the times. And I was like, what is wrong with me? There is no reason to be happy about this shit. Another hour long sitting here, walking, sitting, walking. But I was having these experiences of being so concentrated that the hindrances weren't my experience and the joy was my experience. And there was no good reason for meditative joy. Now, and you know, saying it, you've got to be careful all of the joy junkies who are like, okay, cool, I want to meditate because I want that. Also remembering that these experiences are still subject to the three characteristics, impermanent, and watching the joy arise and sustain and pass. And then watching the craving mind cling to it and want more of that. I asked you at the beginning of class, what I should have asked, maybe I'll do next week, what's an interesting experience that you've spent the last several months or years trying to get back? Because sometimes when we have these meditative phenomena, the joy unlocks, or maybe get really, you know, the next one on the list is tranquility. You have that experience of being completely serenity, settled. And then the second noble truth comes in and starts chasing joy or chasing peace or chasing, trying to get back to that experience that you had at your first retreat, or that experience that you had whenever it was, your 10th retreat, and the craving to repeat it rather than just being open to, let's see what happens next. See what happens. It might come back. What we do know is that it'll pass. Whatever it is, it's not going to last. You don't, it's not going to be, you know, permanent bliss. Bliss will come and bliss will go. Serenity will come and serenity will go. Now, the last thing on the list maybe is, if you're going to go for anything that you're going to try to maintain, it's equanimity. Because equanimity is that part of the heart and the mind that is really at ease with whether there's joy or there's sorrow, whether there's praise or there's blame, whether there's gain or there's loss. That part of the mind that, you know, it opens up when you clean off the slide and there, you know, the hindrances aren't attacking, and that equanimity with the vicissitudes of being and the joys and sorrows of existence. And that's not addicted to pleasure and not aversive to pain, but has the wisdom that pleasure and pain are unavoidable parts of existence. And neither of them are the source of happiness or unhappiness. Only wisdom is the source of happiness. And only ignorance is the cause of unhappiness. Equanimity, it's wisdom. So if you get very concentrated, you will experience, this is the map, you will experience the seven factors. You get very gathered, the hindrances will go away. They'll be at bay, and you'll experience joy, and you'll experience equanimity, and you'll experience tranquility. The mind will become calm, like Ajahn Chah said, if you let go absolutely, the mind will become like a still forest pool, and all kinds of strange and wonderful animals will come to drink from the pool. And that will happen, temporarily. And then you get self-centered again, and then you get tranquil, and then you get afraid again, and then you get tranquil, and then you, it's a process, it's an ongoing process. I'm not big on concentration. The Buddha, although it's part of the path, it's on this list, it's on many lists, it's part of the practice that we're doing. But the Buddha also warned against using concentration as a bypass. It's too easy to, if you use concentration, you will experience bliss, and then you'll get addicted to being concentrated and blissed out, but not open to all of your emotions and all of your impermanent experience. And concentration doesn't teach you compassion very well. It doesn't teach you non-reactivity very well. It teaches you how to avoid and the joy of avoidance, right? Feels so good to experience these joy, tranquility, equanimity, because you are ignoring the hindrances. A couple weeks ago, and my primary perspective is, I think we're better served with the mindfulness that engages with the hindrances rather than tries to meditate them away. That has a relationship with Mara rather than just get so concentrated that we're able to ignore it. So that it's more portable for all of our lives, present time, non-judgmental, kind, investigative awareness, that maybe we don't experience as much deep states of tranquility, but we're less identified and less reactive to life, to the mind, to the body, to our, in our relationship. Maybe it's both and, right? It's not, I don't think it's either or. But I know for me, my tendency is more emphasis on present time navigation of difficult emotions rather than trying to meditate into the awakened experiences of joy. They happen. If you go on lots of retreats, they'll happen whether you like it or not, probably. But don't get addicted to them. A few minutes for questions or clarifications, or is what I'm saying making sense? Do you feel like you learned something about these seven factors? Is there any questions about it? Please, Frank.
I love what you said about innate joy, and this idea that it's part of us and it's always there. You probably said that before, but just for some reason, it really rung my bell tonight. I think part of it is, coming from an addict background and having a lot of wreckage and damage in my past. I don't feel like I deserve it a lot of times, but this idea that it's always there and it's innate and it's just part of my nature is such a beautiful thought. And something else I've been thinking of a lot, or running across a lot in reading and stuff and listening to people, and I don't know if I've heard you talk about it before, but this idea of Buddha nature that we all have. And is that, would you link those two together? Is that kind of innate joy as part of just,
Yeah. In the Buddha nature is more of a Mahayana northern school of Buddhism concept, but in the Theravada, this is how we talk about Buddha nature, these awakened innate potentials, the citta, the wisdom and the sukha and the piti and the joy and that these are innate parts. Even just nirvana being a potential for all living beings who are willing to train the mind. That's what they mean by Buddha nature, that it is in us. It's something that we can awaken to. Even the image of the difference between being asleep or awake, anybody, we're all asleep, and we all could wake up because we have that ability. It's part of sometimes nature sounds a little bit too much, to me, a little bit too much like it's gonna happen. Like it's the nature to happen, like awakening, your Buddha, like it's just gonna naturally happen. And that's not true. It's not gonna fucking happen if you don't work real hard for it for a real long time. Against the stream, right? Like you can read the books and you can hear the Dharma talks, but if you don't meditate and destroy the causes of suffering in your life, you're not gonna naturally wake up. It takes effort on this list. It takes discipline. It takes renunciation. It takes long-term, loving, kind, disciplined engagement with the heart and mind to unlock that nature. It takes effort. It's against the stream. So, yes, it is Buddha nature. It is innate to us. It is part of our potential in all of us. And I like, even you didn't quite ask this, but came to mind for me that part of us that doesn't feel like we deserve it, part of what's being said here is that it's not something that you earn. It's not even something that you attain. It's something that you uncover that has always been here. And, I kind of like, yeah, actually, none of us deserve it. It's just who we are, it's what we are. And nobody doesn't deserve it, and nobody does deserve it. It's, this image of the Buddha touching the earth, Mara's final attack when he says, his mind says to him, who do you think you are? Unworthiness. And he touches the earth. And he says, I'm the four elements, and we're all the four elements, and that's enough worth. Nobody's more worthy, nobody's less worthy, nobody's more entitled, nobody's. Based, all of the merit is based in action. And how much are we willing to train our mind? How much are we willing to practice some renunciation? How much are we willing to show up and do the work? And if you're willing to show up and do the work, you get as free as your karma allows. You purify your karma as much as you can. Mike Rubio at home, go ahead, jump in.
Hey Noah, I'm not sure if this is a question or observation, but for some reason, this meditation really got me to a space of tranquility. After a while, I was feeling just so chill and calm and peaceful. And the hindrance that came up was, I think, around doubt. It was like, no, I've been suffering a lot lately, as many people have with news cycle, with like fear, with anxiety, with what's going on in this country. And it's there's the doubt was like, you can't feel this. Like you can't feel it just chill and okay. It's unsafe to it. And I think what you're saying is that, I think my mistake is that I'm trying to make it permanent. Like, oh, I'm believing that it's gonna be permanent. And the truth is like it's not. You're saying it's not. And so I'm gonna be coming to the retreat, and I'm looking forward to kind of like delving into this more deeply and getting past it. So I would definitely want your tutelage on it, like, because it's something that really matters to me. The equanimity is like, I really want that right now.
Yeah.
And I, it seems like, impossible.
Well, and it's nice when you get a glimpse like that of like, actually, it's not impossible. I'm getting glimpses in my meditation of some tranquility. And then, it's that, oh, there was a moment of ease, well-being, tranquility, and then Mara attacked. Oh, you don't deserve this, or it's, you're the clinging or the fear or the whatever it is that comes in there. That's part of the dance. And then, keep sitting, and then you say, oh, okay, I see that hindrance of aversion or of doubt coming in. And then you keep going. And that's the process, that there's a moment of wisdom, and then there's a moment of identification with a confused part of the mind. And you keep investigating, be like, okay, isn't that interesting? There was a little bit of the awakening factor, and then the hindrance swung right in and knocked it out of the box. Okay, isn't that interesting? Let me keep going. You don't get to keep it. And yes, the hindrance will, often when the hindrances are more powerful, they'll just push the wisdom right out of the way. But you got a glimpse. Oh, there is some wisdom in here. There is, like you were talking about, Frank, there is some joy in here. There's doubt that I deserve it, but there is some joy in here. Interesting. Let me keep exploring. Please, Ryan.
If I kind of, I guess, I feel like I've gotten to a place that I've been sitting for so long. We were talking about this, that like, mindfulness, it's very like kind of wash, rinse, repeat in a lot of ways. Like I heard you say one time, oh, my fucking mind again. And do you have any suggestions of like kind of breaking up that process or doing something like slightly recalibrating the mindfulness practice?
Yeah, sure. Could you hear it at home? The question? So he's talking about kind of having a somewhat long-term meditation practice and it becoming mundane or kind of same old, same old. So there's a couple of things you can do. Like if you are used to starting with mindfulness of the breath at the nostrils, shift to the belly and use the rising and falling of the belly rather than the nostrils. Just shift it. Or kind of do the sound of silence, that ringing in the ears. Like take 6 months or a year or something, and say, that'll be my primary object. And I'll sh rather than, because I now I can kind of like pretend like I'm paying attention to my breath while I'm thinking about other shit. So let me try to do something else. Moving, it's good to there's so many instructions to kind of shift around, even in the body first foundation. There's lots of different ways. It doesn't have to be breath at the nostrils or at the belly. You can switch, you can do something else, just like primary object, hands on your knees, or your ass on the cushion, or the sound of the ringing in your ears. And something like that, which will make you pay attention a little bit closer, can really help shift it. If you want to get concentrated, there's interesting ways to do like ladder counting of your breath. Like, breathing out 7, breathing in 6, breathing out 5, breathing in 4, and then getting down to 1 and breathing in 2, breathing out 3, breathing. And something that you have to really be very present for in order to not lose count. Starting on the out breath rather than the in breath, or, kind of watching the natural. Oh, it's easy when I'm breathing out 1. Oh, actually, breathing in 1 is harder for me to track. So things like that can be interesting. I hope that's useful. That's mostly for first foundation stuff. I don't know. And then committing to heart practices at times and saying, like, I'm going to do 90 days of self-forgiveness, whether I feel like it or not. I'm going to just, I forgive you as much as I can. And I'll do that for 3 months. or 6 months or 9 years or whatever it is, whether I feel like it or not. I'm going to do the loving kindness, or I'm going to do the compassion or the forgiveness, so that I'm not just using mindfulness as an avoidance technique, but I'm really developing the emotional bandwidth that the Dharma provides. Yeah, you're careful what you ask for. Jesse, go ahead. Last question, I think.
You covered it a little bit last week, and I was trying to explain it to somebody, and he said I did a good job, and I felt great about that. I'm not sure if I did a great job, so I was wondering if you could just talk about it a little bit, the difference between what enlightenment is in Hinduism as opposed to Buddhism, and also, like you said, something along the lines of our true state beneath, under everything is bliss in Hinduism, and Buddha was like, no.
Mm-hmm.
And also, did Buddha think that Hinduism was avoidance of, you know, the hindrances and avoiding like real shit that you gotta deal with through meditation?
It's a big question. I'm not actually educated enough in the Vedas and Upanishads and what we're referring to as kind of, you know, pre-Buddhist Indian philosophy that sometimes is referred to as Hinduism. Some of my yogi friends get offended by being called Hindus. That they're like, I'm practicing an Indian methodology that is not Hinduism. It's Vedic. It's based in the Upanishads or the Rig Veda or some, you know, something that's not classic what has become known as Hinduism. And one of them's here tonight, so I'm gonna have to be really careful for what I say. Here's what I can say is that the Buddha tried, when he was looking for enlightenment, to find spiritual teachers that could teach him how to get free. And the ones that he found, he said, mostly taught me how to concentrate the mind, and that concentrating the mind led to these states of bliss and even emptiness and stuff, but they didn't lead to a permanent transformation of my relationship to pleasure and pain and the self. They gave me these big meditative phenomena, but that when the concentration wore off, I still was attached and aversive and identified with I, me, and mine. And he didn't find anybody in that, what we could call Hindu pre-Buddhist lineages, that led him to that. What's that?
I don't know if I said Hindu, but yeah. I also don't know about it. I also was including the
Buddha's previous teachers.
Yes.
Yeah. That's part of the story of the Buddha. And throughout his, after he came to his awakening, he was down on teachings of kind of external kind of deity worship, and even the kind of rituals that a lot of the Hindu kind of bathing in the sacred river. At one point, you know, somebody, a Brahmin, comes to the Buddha and says, "Do you even bathe in the sacred rivers? You know, this is like part of our thing. Like, don't you know that you need to go wash away your sins in these rivers?" And the Buddha said to him, and this is a teaching that you've maybe heard from me before, it's the kind of prequel to the simile of the cloth, and he said, actually, my practice is internal bathing. I don't go out to the river to bathe. I bathe, I purify, I cleanse my teaching is an internal purification of cleaning all of the stains off of the heart, off of the cloth of our being. And so he does have some confrontations with the Indian Brahmanical Hindu teachers of his time, and he's a non-theist, and a lot of that is theism. Even though some of it, even the Vedantic Advaita non-dualists, there's still a bit of a sort of God consciousness, that the Buddha is just like, we don't talk, that's not part of this. This is, he doesn't say this, but here's how I hear it. I'm teaching the nature of the human being. It's humanist psychology. It's not about deities. It's not about gods. It's not about any external refuge. It's about the human potential to awaken with their own effort in this lifetime. And there's no divine intervention to it. And a lot of the Hindu stuff is about divine intervention. And, you know, Shiva's going to help, and Hanuman's going to help, and Krishna's going to help. And, you know, if you chant their name correctly, you will get some divine intervention, some grace, some blessings. Or even maybe the guru will help. And the Buddha himself said, I'm not a guru. I can't help you at all. The only way I can help you is I'll give you some really good instructions of how to train your own mind. It's the only help I can give you. Here's how to do it. But hanging out with me is not going to make you any happier, any more free. Your meditation will make you happier and more free. Okay, that's it. Couple of announcements. 5-day retreat, May 13th through 18th. You're all invited. If you haven't registered yet, please register. Come to the 5-day silent. You will experience, you'll get at least a taste of the 7 factors of awakening. It might just be a little bit of mindfulness or concentration, but who knows, maybe you'll get some joy or some equanimity, some tranquility. Come to the retreat if you can. The Sri Lanka 2-week surf retreat, pilgrimage, shopping spree, adventure is happening November 10th through 24th, and it is open for registration. Sebastian and I got it up. It's on the website. If you're coming, you probably want to plan. You got to get plane tickets. You got to get 2 or 3 weeks off of your life to come to the other side of the planet. Sri Lanka is the oldest living Buddhist culture on the planet. Other than India, but Buddhist culture in India is kind of gone. They're trying to reviving it in some ways, but there's been an unbroken lineage in Sri Lanka for 2,500 years. It's the oldest living tradition. So we're going there. We're going to surf. We're going to do some silent retreat. If you don't surf, you can still come. You can hang out on the beach. Eric will teach you how to surf. It's going to be a great trip. So I hope a lot of you are able to come. It's not cheap. Traveling across the country, across the world is not cheap. But if it's within your means, I hope you join us. I think that's it. Class is done by donation. Please be as generous as you can be. Sebastian wants to tell me something else.
The Sri Lanka, you get a better price if you purchase it soon.
Yeah.
You're
going to save a few $100 if you register within the next 1 month. After that, the price goes up a few hundred. So early bird registration. Carrot. We'll save some money. But then if you register early and you cancel later, you get a $500. It's not, I don't know. We're going to tax you if you cancel later. So may any goodness that comes from our practice be shared with each other. Shared with our benefactors, shared with our communities. May this goodness, this merit, these blessings of our good intentions be shared outward in all directions with all living beings. May each one of us get as free as possible in this lifetime. And together, may we create a positive change on this planet. Thank you. Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. This is Noah Levine, founder of Against the Stream and Refuge Recovery. If you feel moved to leave a donation, there's a link in the show notes.